really nobody whose interests throughout his life and career have spanned our interests. Everybody knows his contributions to standard model of particle physics. It's fair to say, Girard is a very straightforward and modest person, so I don't want to embarrass him too much, but I think it's fair to say that nobody contributed more to the understanding and development and establishment of the standard model of particle physics. And he's also somebody enormously creative and independent-minded, which are what we value here as well. And his interests have also gone over to black hole physics, to, oh, there's the microphone, thank you, to foundations of quantum mechanics, the holographic principle of Girard from 1993. We don't know if it's correct or not, but it's certainly the most provocative, and now that's too much. The most provocative and inspiring idea, and certainly in the world of quantum gravity and foundations of quantum physics, there's not another idea that I and others of us have thought more about and tried to understand the implications of and realize. So anyway, I don't want to take Girard's time away. We're very honored and fortunate to have him here with us as a visitor for these weeks here. And for those of you who want more, there's a public lecture tonight. I think it's sold out, but talk to us. I'm not supposed to say that, but tonight at 7 o'clock at Waterloo Collegiate Institute, and we're very happy. And with that, Girard.
Well, thank you very much, Lee, for your very kind introduction. For me, it's a great joy to be here. It's the first time that I'm visiting this institute, and now it's my turn to be very much impressed by this large and beautiful institute. I think it's the largest one I've ever seen, entirely devoted to the highest echelons of purely theoretical physics and the most interesting things we are trying to study. Today's talk is devoted to a question. In fact, I always ask myself deep questions about how to proceed from what we know. What we know today is now very easy to summarize in terms of it is the standard model. What you know about the fundamental interactions of nature, in the early 70s, this was the picture. We had electrons, muons, three kinds of quarks, which came in three colors. And already a picture was emerging about the lowest line here, a gauge series consisting of W plus, W minus bosons, a Z boson, and then eight gluons. And that picture was soon to be made more perfect with a fourth quark called Chern, and then somewhat later, a whole new generations of both quarks and leptons. That model shows a remarkable extent of completeness. It really describes all fundamental particles that we know of in the world with great accuracy. The one missing component is at the lower right in black, the Higgs particle. We are all quite confident that it will be detected, actually perhaps in the next few coming years, hopefully by the LHC detector in Geneva. A thing that thing will definitely not detect is one component called the graviton. And as most of you must know, the missing ingredient in a standard model, the most conspicuously missing ingredient, is how to put in gravity correctly. With correctly, I mean not only the perturbative theory. We understand very, very well how to describe gravity without involving all its quantum peculiarities. We have Einstein's brilliant theory of general relativity describing gravity in great detail. So you can ask, what else do we want? Well, what we want is mathematical precision and consistency with everything known about quantum mechanics. And here is where all the very deep and mysterious problems appear. So what do we have? In the standard model, we know that you have to start with basically three types of fundamental fields. Scalar fields, which have no preferred direction in space, apart from where you define those fields, the coordinates x. Those are very well described by the so-called Klein-Gordon equation, and they describe particles, their quanta are particles with spin zero. Then we have the famous Dirac equation, which describes all the particles with spin 1/2. And finally, the most peculiar and beautiful feature of the standard model is the set of spin 1 fields, the gauge particles, all described by Young-Mills equations. And all that together is a complete picture. You can't, without paying a lot, you can't add higher spin particles. You can try to do that, but then you discover that the theory will no longer have this very desirable property of being renormalizable. Renormalizable really means that no matter how deep you go into the theory, no matter how large the energies are that you are looking at, the same set of equations basically describe a situation that you are looking at. So the theory works at a fantastic array of scales, therefore with a fantastic accuracy due to the fact that the theory is renormalizable. Now, the case of gravity is quite something else. First, let me explain to you why the graviton has spin 2. Now, most of you, quite a few of you, have worked with gravity, and they know gravity is associated with an energy quantum, and that energy quantum is an object with spin 2. But there's a nice way of explaining that in non-technical terms, why the graviton has spin 2. And I'd like to explain that in terms of the gravitational field as it acts between the moon and the Earth. So think of the Earth and the moon, and there's water on the Earth, and the moon attracts the water. Water at that side of the Earth that is facing the moon is being attracted. At the opposite side of the Earth, it's actually being expelled. How can that be? Well, actually, the moon is rotating around the Earth, but the Earth also shows a tiny amount of anti-rotation just to keep the center of gravity at one spot. The center of gravity actually sits inside Earth, somewhat closer to the moon, but actually the Earth wobbles quite a bit. And that wobbling motion implies that water away from the moon is being basically catapulted, centrifuged to the outside. So you have two bulges, and that explains the tides, which occur twice per day. It's high tide, and twice per day it's low tide, except for the fact that the moon also rotates around the Earth. Now you can ask, how does this tidal movement depend on where the moon is? So let's rotate the moon 90 degrees, and then the tides look like this. Rotate another 90 degrees, and then the tides are basically the same as before. So if I put the moon 180 degrees at the other side of the Earth, then the tides are essentially the same, apart from very minor differences. On top of that, you have the effect from the sun, which is in another direction. The sun may reinforce or reduce the effect a little bit. So you may have leap tide and lower tide. But that's a minor detail. What I want to focus at is the peculiar feature that if the moon rotates only halfway, the tidal configuration of the Earth is back to the same position where it was. So here you can talk about a force that basically switches twice when you go fully around the Earth. So when you follow a curve around the Earth of 360 degrees, you see twice you see high tide and twice you see low tide. So this is a force that switches twice. If you now compare that with a wave function of a particle which with orbital angular momentum, you find that the wave function goes up and down twice when the particle goes around, or observer goes around that spot. This is typical for spin 2, or for angular momentum 2. And what you have to say now is that the gravitational force, as the moon exerts it on the Earth, has a spin 2 character. Now, this argument might not be totally compelling, and you might think there are many ways to shoot holes in this argument. But I do claim it conveys some of the basic aspects of gravity, and it indeed is a prosaic way to describe the argument why the graviton is a spin 2 particle. So, and that means that it is not renormalizable, because I just said minutes ago that to get a renormalizer theory, the spin should not be more than one. There's another phenomenon that's very closely related to this. If you take the photon, which is typically spin 1 particle, which describes the electromagnetic force between two charges, then you find that the photon causes an attractive force when you have opposite charges. So the proton and electron are attracted towards each other in spite of the fact that the charges are opposite. If the charges would have been equal, they repel each other. And that's a typical feature of electromagnetism. Opposite charges attract. In the case of gravity, it's the other way around. Equal masses, equal particles attract. They don't repel, they attract. And this is typically a consequence of the fact that the photon has spin 1, but the graviton has spin 2. And if you actually spin 2 particle, this feature of when does a thing attract, when does a thing repel, goes the other way around. Well, particles and antiparticles also attract each other, but antiparticles also have mass positive. If you be able to generate something with negative mass, which is very difficult or impossible to do, then you would find gravitational repulsion. So you see that in many respects, gravity is opposite from electromagnetism. Now, in the ordinary world, even the fact that the graviton has a spin 2 is not so much of a problem. Gravity is such a tremendously weak force that those subtle quantum effects, which will cause problems, are usually invisible. The reason for that is, the fundamental units that you use, that you work with when we do physics. In fact, the so-called Planck units are derived the following way. We have three fundamental constants describing this world when we have gravitational force. One is Planck's constant, which is a number that you can express in terms of kilograms, meters squared per second. The velocity of light, which is just a number of meters per second. And then there is Newton's constant, which can be expressed in meter cubed per kilogram per second squared. Well, this you might not have realized by head. It's something I always forget myself. But you can take those three quantities, and you can try to find certain combinations of those. You can ask for when do these particles have combinations such that they form a unit of a dimension of a length, a unit of a dimension of a mass, or a unit of a dimension of time, or any other dimensionality. You discover if you take h bar and multiply that by Newton's constant, divide by c to the third, and take the square root of that, then you get a quantity which has a dimension of a length. A different combination, the second combination here, has a dimension of a mass, and the third combination has a dimension of time. So, and you can figure out, if you can calculate faster than I can, you can figure out from these numbers which combination to take that it all works. The quantity of dimension length is absurdly small. 10 to the minus 33 centimeters is much, much smaller than anybody can find, can measure, even in the best particle accelerators. Particles never get, we never see structures that small, even in the highest energy particle accelerators. The time unit is even more ridiculous. 10 to the minus 44 seconds is an absurdly tiny time unit. If someone wants to sell you a laptop claiming that it switches 10 to the 44 times per second, don't buy it because he's a cheat. Because you can't, it is suspected that no chip exists which will have such a fast speeding switching velocity as 10 to the, as one switch in 10 to the minus 44 seconds. It's probably kind of a limiting speed in nature. The interesting unit is the unit of mass, about 20 micrograms. That's the mass of a tiny grain of sugar, or perhaps a somewhat larger unicellular animal or something. So why don't all physicists use that unit of mass as the fundamental God-given unit? The reason for that is that actually all these three constants, Newton's constant is rather poorly known, only one part per thousand or so. That's not very accurate, and many physicists want to measure mass much more accurately than that. So they can't use this unit, unfortunately. But it would be sort of a God-given unit of mass. Now, the spin 2 is only one of the problems, but there are many problems in trying to understand gravity when you combine it with quantum mechanics. So the renormalizability means that you get infinities at small distances. In fact, at any distance scale as small as 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, the gravitational effects start to dominate over all other forces, becoming so tremendously strong that we can't do any calculations anymore. It really means that the theory is non-renormalized, which means at momentum scales, which would cause wave functions with that wavelength or anything like that, or energy, which corresponds to a frequency or a Planck frequency, those energies would be energies where the theory starts to diverge. And then there are contradictions in when you try to study black holes. Now, we turn to the topic of black holes very soon, so and I'll show what kind of difficulties there are. In case of quantum mechanics of our gravity, we'll have a problem of defining what time really means. According to Einstein, space and time are curved. So according to Einstein also, you're free to use your whatever coordinate frame you like in space. So when I talk about locality, you can ask, what does locality really mean if you don't really know what your coordinates are? And these, at first sight, look like rather innocent questions. And as long as we stick to a perturbative formulation of gravity, these questions don't seem to be much of a problem. But when you try to ask more basic questions, then it turns out that these are really quite fundamental difficulties. So we ask all sorts of nasty questions. Do we have a wave function of the universe and the like? A very intriguing difficulty with gravity that tells us that there's something very basically wrong with our understanding is a so-called cosmological constant. The cosmological constant is a term that could be added to Einstein's equations without really invalidating any of its basic principles. Instead of having the Lagrangian to be the usual Einstein Lagrangian, which is a number which is defined as units in terms of Newton's constant, times the fundamental curvature of space and time, that quantity appears in Einstein's Lagrangian. But Einstein himself already realized he would add a constant to that. And adding this constant multiplied with the volume factor in the Lagrangian does mean that you are modifying your equations, and it would give rise to a curved universe. It would give rise also to static solutions of the universe, as was the hope that Einstein once had, to get a static description of the universe. But basically, the constant is there, or could be there. It has been measured rather recently that indeed, quite likely, there is such a constant in Einstein's equation. It is not zero. However, it is extremely small. Even though it is not zero, it's interesting that it has been measured. The most striking feature of gravity theory that whether or not this constant is there, it has an absurdly small value. It is so small that only at cosmological scales it starts to contribute. Because lambda has a different dimensionality than the other terms in gravity, it means that the effect of the cosmological constant will accumulate at very, very large distances. So at distant scales of the size of the universe itself, the effects of lambda become noticeable. Whereas at distant scales of the Planck length, the effects of quantum gravity become noticeable. Why are there so such vastly different distance scales in gravity? And you can just shake your head and say, oh, well, it's a problem left for the future. But there's another way of phrasing difficulty which shows you how absurd this problem actually is. Both lambda and R represent the kind of stiffness of the universe. And let me explain that. R means that the universe resists being curved. If you try to curve the universe, then the fact that there's a curvature term in Lagrangian means that the Einstein equations try to counteract, to react against any curvature. Space and time are very nearly perfectly flat. In fact, it has taken humanity a long time to even realize that space and time are not perfectly flat, in spite of the presence of gravitational forces. It just means that the deviation from flatness of space and time is very, very small. The real reason for that is that Newton's constant, which is a very small constant, appears downstairs here. So the coefficient from the curvature is 1 over Newton's constant, give or take some 8 pi or so. But So this term here is very, very large, very, very strong, resisting any curvature in the universe. Now this lambda term only looks at the volume of the universe, and that is very small. So we have a universe, a space-time structure, that resists against curvature, but does not resist against scale transformations. If you scale anything to a different size, then the only term that would contribute would now be lambda. But lambda is very, very small, as this term is very, very large. And to illustrate that, and I want to give you a model of a space-time, a fake kind of model, that shows how to make stiffness with respect to curvature, yet freedom or non-stiffness with respect to scale transformations. And here you see a fabrication of an object which keeps its same triangular shape when you stretch it, but it is very easy to make it large and make it small. So here you see, you can think of now the whole universe being built out of such little triangles, triangles which can be made larger or smaller quite easily, but they all keep the same shape. So now you can imagine, in fact, if we buy it in a shop some time ago, you could imagine constructions made out of this. So you can imagine many of these triangles, which together form a three-dimensional structure, which you can stretch quite easily. It costs no energy at all to stretch it, up to some extent, but to change its shape is very hard. Well, actually, some of you, particularly those who have some experience in mechanics, will say, well, it's not so difficult to change its shape. Look at all those hinges. If I step on it, the shape will change definitely. So the reason for that is this thing is very weak. And to make this thing very sturdy out of solid material is actually hard. So I could think of those hinges to be very, very strong, and all these little gears to be made of very, very strong material, so that even if you step on it, it keeps its same shape. But you need very, very strong material of a very peculiar type. And now think of making a very, very large structure out of this. It's going to be even harder to make that sturdy, because if maybe this triangle is strong, but if I have 1,000 of these triangles and make them to some three-dimensional object, then I can, again, stretch it and shrink it. But now, if I step on it, it will still break. Well, imagine now a structure like this, given it the size of the universe, whereas the individual hinges are given the size of the Planck length. So that gives you enormously large structures made of this form. And now I say it is still sturdy. How the hell did nature accomplish such a feat? So this is the big mystery of the cosmological constant. If you want a microscopic theory that has such a small constant, you're really thinking of exaggerating this to the entire size of the universe and still have it sturdy. It's really inconceivable, and yet somehow nature pulls this trick, and we don't understand how it works. So, so if you have questions like this, then it's really obvious that we should somehow have a theoretical way to address these questions. How can you address questions of this sort? Well, the answer I would like to give to this is, if gravity gives us so much of a problem, let's look at that situation where gravity is as strong as it ever can be. Well, gravitational force is as strong as it ever will be anywhere, and that's near the horizon of a black hole. A black hole, as you know probably, is a region of space-time that arises when large amounts of matter collapse, giving just a remnant that only has a gravitational force and nothing else. If you have such a black hole, then the gravitational force near that black hole is very, very strong. Nowhere in nature will the gravitational fields become stronger than that with respect to size. Large objects will have relatively weak fields again. Tiny black holes will have the strongest gravitational fields ever. So if you have questions to ask about gravity, look at tiny black holes. That is, roughly speaking, the answer I'd give to that question. Now I'm going to present to you a view as if, which is the following, that in fact every elementary particle, including particularly the ones that are featured in the standard model, all these particles can, in a certain sense, be viewed as little black holes. Why I'm saying this? Well, every particle generates a gravitational field. So it's right to say that a particle has a gravitational field surrounding it. If you write down the full Einstein equations for that gravitational field, you'll find the same solution as Schwarzschild had, which is it would be like a black hole with a horizon. The only catch here, of course, is that this horizon is extremely tiny. So the black hole has a finite size, but that size is so small that it is insignificant for all practical purposes. It is indeed much, much smaller than the Planck length for ordinary particles. So I can say, yes, a particle is a black hole, but no, in practice, that means nothing. You can better consider the particle as a point particle, and that works much better in practice. But now when it comes to principal matters, to matters of principle, you might say, well, but they do obey exactly the same equations. So there may not be a very fundamental distinction between particles and black holes. The converse is also true. A black hole, in a sense, can also be viewed as an elementary particle. And I'll explain the arguments for that. I'll say what those arguments are, but I'm going to explain those. Black holes are just like particles. They come in different sizes and spins and excitations and such, but they are represented by distinct states, distinct quantum states, and as such, they resemble the particles. Remember, in the old days, in the 60s and 70s, every year, at CERN and other places, particle laboratories, a new list of elementary particles was edited, and this contained all known elementary particles of nature, and they made a big list of them, giving the names, every particle had spin, mass, and so on, and also the properties that we measured. Every particle that people could detect had a name. Now, if black holes are added to this list, they have a very large set of names to be added to the Rosenfeld tables. Oh yes, these were called after Leon Rosenfeld, and they were called the Rosenfeld tables. Now, so it looks a little bit like the following, like we have the following situation. We have a spectrum of particles where here goes, mass goes vertically in a very logarithmic way. So below we have all known physical particles until we reach something like the Higgs particles. That's where today's limit is. At very much higher energies, you have some grand unification taking place. And at still higher energies, black holes will start to emerge. That's where the Planck length begins. And black holes, as I will argue, will have many, many different distinct quantum states. So this looks like a more or less continuum picture of states. We don't really understand very well the situation here because it's beyond what we can measure now. We don't really know very well, even less, of course, about this region, although there's a suspicion that just below the region where black holes start to come, there will be a fundamental unification taking place. All forces appear to be equal in this domain. That's a very interesting piece of information that can be derived from what we know about the standard model today. So important things happen here, although none of us really understands the full details of what's going on. And then here there are even more point-like particles, and we call them ordinary black holes. But the claim is there's no fundamental distinction between particles and black holes. All this came about in the early 70s when the guy sitting here in the middle, Stephen Hawking, came with a very brilliant idea. Here in this picture, by the way, Stephen Hawking is playing a role in Star Trek. And there are two actors here, one playing Einstein, one playing Newton. The third actor is Stephen Hawking playing Stephen Hawking. And I can tell you more about this, but I now want to return to the physics. Stephen made a very important elementary observation, and that is that if you have a black hole, then you get what you call vacuum fluctuations. Well, vacuum fluctuations always occur according to quantum field theory everywhere. So you always have fluctuating particles everywhere in the universe, including near the horizon of a black hole. And the horizon of the black hole splits space and time in two regions. Region one is a so-called outside region. If you're outside the horizon, you are free to escape to infinity if you have a strong engine in your spaceship. But inside the horizon, you cannot escape to infinity. You are doomed to die within the black hole, and nobody will notice the thing outside. Now, inside the horizon, particles can have negative energy. If energy is being measured by an outside observer, then the measurement gets so distorted by the gravitational field that the particle inside, if you try to measure its energy, would have negative energy. The particle outside is the only particle that can escape to infinity. And now imagine that you have vacuum fluctuations. That is to say, pairwise, particles are created annihilated. If it happens, there happens to be a fluctuation on the horizon, then one particle might escape to infinity, and one particle might go to the origin of space and time at the horizon. Now, the total energies add up to zero. So if the particle that runs to infinity has some positive energy in order to reach infinity, the other particle must have negative energy, and that's allowed since it sits inside the black hole. But once it sits inside the black hole, it can no longer reach its companion outside because it cannot escape. And so the result of this is what started out as a vacuum fluctuation, which is utterly invisible. There's vacuum fluctuations all around us here, but nobody notices a thing. They are not observable. Even in particle physics experiments, you don't observe these vacuum fluctuations directly. Only in a very indirect sense, you see that particles appear to have some jittering motion when they move around that could be attributed to vacuum fluctuations, but you don't observe them directly. Well, you do observe them directly here. If you could make observations close to a black hole, you would definitely observe particles going to infinity out of the horizon. You would not observe these, but you would observe these. And in fact, you can calculate that any species of particle will come out. So no matter what kind of particle it is, no matter what the list of particles is in your Rosenfeld tables, all the entries there will show particles that will come out. And the only thing you have to know is how they contribute to the vacuum fluctuations. And then you can calculate how many of them come out. And Hawking was the first to calculate that. At first, he thought there was something wrong with his approach because he had not expected that anything could come out of the black hole. But then he calculated something very interesting. He calculated the intensity of these particles coming out and discovered that they were thermal particles, as if the black hole was heated to a temperature given by this formula. K is Boltzmann's constant, h by c to the third, h by Newton's constant, divided by the mass of the black hole. That is, the lighter the black hole, the more intense the radiation will be, because the intensity of the radiation will go like a fourth power of the temperature. So if the mass is reduced by one half, the temperature will be 16 times, will be twice as big, and therefore the intensity is 16 times as high. But you have to remember that the surface is also smaller by factor 4. So actually, if the black hole reduces its mass by factor 2, the end result of the intensity is about 4 times as much. So the intensity rapidly increases if the black hole of the mass would decrease. And the result of that is that a tiny black hole will lose mass faster and faster and eventually explode. So this is the famous Hawking effect. Black holes emit particles. By emitting particles, they will lose mass and weight. They will reduce in size because of that. The radiation will intensify, and in the very end, the black hole will explode. Now, this is a very interesting observation, precisely because it's quantitative. You can calculate exactly the temperature that the black hole has. One can sometimes argue this phenomenon has never been observed. Is the calculation correct? And sometimes you can think, well, Hawking did make some fundamental assumptions about black holes. I think those assumptions are very probably right, but it could be wrong because we are extrapolating laws of nature beyond the domain where they have ever been explicitly checked. So we can't be entirely certain that Hawking temperature is really the way he calculated it. But most of us do believe that he is probably right. Now, assuming that he is right, you can do the following very interesting Gedanken experiment. Consider a black hole and consider matter in the form of an alarm clock. This reminds me to see check time. And I take that alarm clock and I throw it into the black hole. When I throw it into the black hole, the black hole will gain weight. So it becomes a little bit bigger and so on. Well, this black hole will also emit objects. Anything can come out. All you have to say is, how does it contribute to the vacuum fluctuations? So even keys and coins can come out, although it's very improbable. But in principle, anything can come out. And you can calculate the probability of these objects to come out. Well, these are usually verified in the maximal tail of the maximal distribution because it's thermal radiation. So normally speaking, you don't expect those objects to come out, but you can compute the probability and it is now vanishing. And that's now a very important piece of information. It's important because you now say there's an emission process, there's an absorption process. And in both directions, we know how effective this process is. You can calculate if you throw something into the black hole, what's the probability that it will actually be eaten by the black hole, or what's the probability that the black hole will miss it and it will just fly by. You can calculate that. You can also calculate what's the intensity of the black hole emitting similar objects. So we have the two-way process, the absorption and emission process. We have some information about that in the two directions. This you now can use. Imagine, for instance, that, and this is a question of quantum states, that a heavier black hole would exist in much, much more quantum states than the lighter black hole. Then you can compute that the absorption process would be favored. In the other case, if the lighter black hole has more states than the heavier black hole, then the emission process would be favored. If you compare the two probabilities, you get the number of quantum states for a black hole. Let me express it differently. In theoretical physics, when we compute some process, some quantum process, and want to compute the probability that the process occurs, for instance, the probability that the particle decays occurs in a quantum decay process, what we teach our students, and we have learned ourselves in our textbooks, is that the total probability can be computed from the quantum mechanics if you take the amplitude, the quantum amplitude. You take the square of the quantum amplitude, and then it says, as you're in the books, you multiply that result with the volume of phase space. Phase space meaning how many different states can the thing evolve into. You have to count them all, and counting that basically corresponds to adding to that expression a volume, the volume of the number of states. So the amplitude, you may assume, to be the same for the two processes. If you assume something which is physically very reasonable, which is time reversal invariance, the emission process is probably equal to the absorption process, but then the time reverse of that. It's all the same thing, it's just backwards in time. So let's assume they're both described by the same quantum amplitude. Well, the volume of phase space is the volume of phase space only of the final state, not the initial state. Now, in the two processes I compare, the final state in one case is the heavier black hole, in the other case it's a lighter black hole plus matter. Now, phase space of matter is all understood. It's all in the textbooks. We know how to do that in the standard model of physics. But what's the phase space of a black hole? This we did not really know yet. But now we can calculate, because now we can compute the phase space of the heavier black hole divided by the phase space of the lighter black hole. And we get some answer, interesting answer, and the outcome of the computation is this. The number of states a black hole can be in turns out to be equal to the number of ways you can draw ones and zeros on the horizon of a black hole. Here I have little squares blinking. Blinking means that they can take the value one or they can take the value zero. If they're on, they're blue. If they're off, they're dark red. And now a large black hole has a large horizon. These little squares all have a fundamental unit of surface area, 10 to the minus 65 square centimeters, which you might recognize as roughly the Planck length squared. So these things that have Planckian dimensions, no matter how big or how small the black hole is. The small black holes have a few states they can be in. Large black holes have many states they can be in. But you can now compare large black holes with small black holes. There's one little caveat in this calculation, which is the following. We've only divided phase space of large black holes with phase space of small black holes. But we don't know the phase space of all black holes in absolute terms. In fact, when you, physically speaking or mathematically speaking, you say when you do the integral, you get an integration constant. That constant means that every single black hole has a number of bits on the side, so to speak. And you don't know how many that is, and we can't compute that. So the total number of states the black hole can be in is given by these blinking squares on the horizon, plus a given number of squares on the side, and this given number of squares on the side is the same for every black hole. So that's probably a number of order one. So maybe it's one, maybe two, maybe 15, or maybe minus one if the black hole cannot be very small. But it's a fixed number, which should be given by some future theory of the black hole. So this is a very peculiar and important answer. And this is the reason why I said a black hole comes in quantum states. This looks very much like a quantized object, where this blinking here is controlled by some Schrodinger equation. And this is where the theory of the quantum mechanics of a black hole starts. I already had this view graph on the screen before, but now the lower line, we now understand why that is so. We now understand why black holes come in distinct quantum states. So that this is a reason to say a black hole is just like an elementary particle. So this leads us to a fundamental view of physics, black hole physics. The following picture comes out. We may have elementary particles. Those are described very well by the Standard Model. There may be many, many more to be discovered, for instance, by LHC in the near future, or in the more distant future by other successors of that. All the way to the Planck length, we expect more and more to discover more and more new elementary particles. Some of those particles may actually form bound states. So two or three together can stick together, like an atomic nucleus. Like the iron nucleus is a bound state of some 56 or so protons and neutrons. That's also possible. So yes, we can have bound states. Some of the bound states are so large that we call them black holes. So the degrees of freedom are on the horizon. Inside blackness, there's no way to extract information from the inside of black holes. Of course, it's understood this thing will Hawking radiate. And you can have very, very large black holes like this. And now the why I call this a hybrid picture is that if you now concentrate on a tiny section of that black hole, of that horizon, then that should be described by ordinary geometry. Someone who falls into a black hole doesn't notice any of these objects there. So that someone will think that he is looking at unperturbed vacuum in space-time, only being attracted and somewhat distorted by tidal forces by this black hole. Now, somehow we must be able to describe the vacuum itself that way, at the same time describe the particles this way. So you see, our task is basically a circular task. We want to make a picture of particles which is consistent. They might form black holes. But as soon as they form black holes, then those have a horizon, and they should again be described as if there are no particles at all. So when you try to make a theory like this, you discover your problem is a circular one. And if you can only solve it once you've solved the previous problem, and then you discover that you return to where you started off from. So we have a very, very high problem in our hands. Solve this circular situation. And in fact, the fact that the number of states in the black hole is controlled by non-particles at the horizon, but not inside, is a notion of holography. It looks as if this shaded region here of the universe, all states it can be in, if it describes part of the black hole, is described by how many particles you can put on this horizon. But that's a two-dimensional surface, whereas space and time is basically, well, space is three-dimensional, time is one-dimensional, altogether four dimensions. So it looks like you want to describe a four-dimensional world in terms of two-dimensional physics. And there seems to be some basic contradiction here. And when I first thought about this notion of holography, I presented it as a fundamental contradiction in physics, something that requires a drastic answer. So how do we, if you ever find an answer, how can we do, are we going to recover locality? Because this horizon of a black hole can be anywhere. In this room, actually, we could be falling in a black hole right now. The horizon of a black hole passes. But that would mean that we are not sitting in this room, but we are all forming degrees of freedom on the horizon of a black hole. This is a fundamental contradiction, or I'd like to call it a paradox. Physicists love paradoxes, because paradoxes mean that there's something you don't understand, and that means there's something you might be able to learn by studying the paradox. It was, after all, Max Planck who was studying a basic paradox in radiation theory at the time. If you apply statistical physics to electromagnetism, you get the result of how much radiation a heated object will emit. And Max Planck realized that the answer was dead wrong, the answer given by physics in his days. So he had to do something about the paradox. And of course, you all know what came out. What came out is a completely different view of reality called quantum mechanics. So the real question is, how does nature process quantum information. And I find it very difficult to imagine that this problem would have nothing to do with the question of the foundations of quantum mechanics itself. After all, we are asking very fundamental questions about the nature of space and time and gravity, about nature's complete set of degrees of freedom. And we are hitting upon this fundamental problem of quantum mechanics. These problems are very likely to be related. So quantum mechanics is normally considered an axiom in all theoretical physics. We say we start describing a Hilbert space. Once you have that, you describe how operators work, and then you make the rest of your theory. Now, general relativity, as I said earlier, has no intrinsic time notion of time. It has no intrinsic notion of space. And it's more and more difficult to understand how nature generates its random numbers. You know very well, when you do a quantum measurement, you detect basically random numbers. And at the smallest distance, you can ask, how does nature produce those random numbers? It was Albert Einstein who didn't believe that random numbers were a fundamental aspect of nature. So he couldn't understand if nature, if God throws dice, how can random numbers come out? And so this was the question Einstein asked is, I don't believe that God plays dice. Somehow, however, Niels Bohr showed him wrong. God does seem to play dice. So now I ask the next question, how does God play dice? Where do these random numbers come from? And I think these fundamental questions have to be answered together with the fundamental questions of how to control nature's degrees of freedom. I'll continue. I don't know how much time I have, really, but I'll continue until someone stops me. And just about talking about quantum mechanics. Fine. So one can ask the question, and usually the question is asked by asking how measurements are being made, how determinism can be built in a theory of measurement and the like. But I'm going to ask the question from the very other end. Imagine that we have some theory which is valid at the Planck scale, but that theory somehow doesn't know about quantum mechanics. Is that conceivable at all? And I say, in principle, you can do something which to me sounds very natural, but I'm hitting against a lot of opposition, so I'm sure this will raise much discussion. If you consider a universe described at the Planck scale, on the one hand, but the entire universe being described, which covers billions of light years in three directions. So you can imagine that's an extremely complicated way of describing the universe, but you can imagine that in principle, all you need to do is write down a number of data describing the universe, data referring to everything there is to be known about the universe. That could be like particles in a position of x. It could be the momentum of the particles, p, but now not non-commuting quantities. So if you describe momenta, at the Planck scale, let's assume that there's no quantum mechanics there, so nothing shows non-commutation. These are commuting quantities describing the state the universe is in. You can have internal degrees of freedom labeled by some index I. Maybe you want to describe the color of someone's hair or something more complicated. But all that together describes the state the universe is in. And now assume that the state evolves deterministically. That is, there's a fundamental law saying how the universe evolves from that state to a next state, and there's no question yes or no. It's a fundamental God-given prescription, a law of nature. A simplified model of that is a universe which can take only three states, state number one, state number two, and state number three. And the theory of everything in this universe would be that state one evolves into state number two. State number two evolves into state number three. State number three evolves into state number one. And you don't need to know anything more. You don't need to know how much time the evolution takes, because this evolution defines time itself. This universe contains its own clock that ticks every time the universe comes back to itself, or something like that. So the universe contains its internal clock, and this is the evolving universe. Now, once you say things this way, nothing stops me from describing that in terms of a permutation matrix. And here comes a little bit of theoretical physics. I take a matrix U, which is a permutation matrix. It contains ones and zeros only. Then at this point, I can decide to introduce interference, but that's just a man-made introduction I consider a state, which is a quantum superposition of these three. And I declare that the squares of those are probabilities. There's nothing physical about this. I just say that I can describe this universe also in a probabilistic theory. I'm not sure which state it is in. Is it in state number one, state number two, or state number three? I only have a probabilistic information about the universe. Well, fine. Then you say the universe is in this particular state, psi. If I do that, I can decide to diagonalize the matrix U. And its eigenvalues are 1, e to the 2 pi I over 3, or e to the minus 2 pi I over 3. And again, nothing stops me from saying that's e to the minus I, h, where h is the Hamiltonian, or else you get this. And this Hamiltonian, then, has 3 eigenstates, 2 pi over 3, 0, and minus 2 pi over 3. So that, by the way, is a Hamiltonian of an atom with spin 1 in the magnetic field. It just looks like that. So now I say, wait a minute, whenever I see an atom with spin 1 in the magnetic field, I now say I can take that atom, rearrange its state such that its evolution operator isn't this one, but that one, if I take the appropriate linear superposition of these three states. And then in terms of this, this atom just hops from state 1 to state 2 to state 3 and back in a deterministic way. So atoms with spin 1 in the magnetic field from now on should be regarded as deterministic objects. But they are deterministic objects in disguise. And now my question is, could quantum mechanics not be exactly that? It's a deterministic theory in disguise. Well, an atom with spin 1 could be a deterministic theory in disguise. You could say the same thing for a theory where the evolution is continuous. You have a dt of q being some f of q. That means that if you apply this, say, to the planetary system, which is a prototype of a deterministic thing, then this q vector should contain the positions and the velocities of the planets. Because then you know that the time derivative of that is another function of the positions and the velocities of the planets. And usually we consider that function f to have a vanishing divergence. That's a technical constraint, not very important, by the way. But I can now introduce an operator p, which is minus I d dq. This is a man-made operator. It doesn't mean anything physically. I can do that for the planets as well as for atoms and so on. And I could write down a Hamiltonian, which is p dot f. This Hamiltonian generates the Schrödinger equation dt of q is a function f of q. So I can, even in a deterministic system, I can find a Hamiltonian that describes the diffusion as if it were a quantum thing. I can introduce wave functions of q and then say these wave functions obey the Schrödinger equation with this Hamiltonian, and then the squares of the amplitudes just describe probabilities. So I can do that for the planetary system. For the planetary system also, I can introduce operators such as the operator that interchanges the position of Mars and Earth, right? I just take Mars, put it there, take Earth, put it there, and then ask, how does the thing evolve? That is a totally valid legal thing to do for the planetary system, but also totally useless. No planetary scientist in his right mind ever considers interchanging Mars and Earth. You can't. But in our minds, we can, and we can ask, how does this interchange operator evolve in time? In a very, very complicated way, I can tell you. But in principle, it does, and you can compute this. So you can use the language of quantum mechanics to describe deterministic things. And this is the idea which I've been playing with the last couple of years to see how far we can push this. There is a very deep problem with the idea. And the problem is that this Hamiltonian here is not bounded from below. So there's no bottom to the energy. Whenever you have a system with a certain energy, you can find another system where the energy is less. Now, this is not a fact in our world. In our world, there is a state which has the lowest possible energy. It is called the vacuum state. The vacuum state has lowest energy. You can't ever get lower than that. You can't get anything out of the vacuum. By definition, you can only put things in. And those things you put in have positive energy. So here you have a quantum system where this fundamental energy principle that has a bottom to the Hamiltonian is violated. Because of that, this quantum system doesn't look at all like quantum systems we are used to. And because of that, one could say that my idea is a complete failure. before saying that, however, I can phrase it in a different way. Consider now a periodic system. A periodic system is a system which, after a certain period t, comes back to itself. Now, that you can also describe the same way by a Hamiltonian. But that Hamiltonian has a property that if I wait for an amount t of time, it goes back into itself, which means e to the minus I t plus Hamiltonian is 1, because it's an identity operator. That means that the eigenstates of Hamiltonian must be integers multiplied by omega, where n is just 1, 0, plus or minus 1, plus or minus 2, and so on. This is the spectrum of that Hamiltonian. Now, if I could somehow remove the negative energy states, then this just looks like the spectrum of a harmonic oscillator. I have to go to precisely halfway and declare that to be zero energy. Then I have something identical to the harmonic oscillator. In fact, the harmonic oscillator with the same period omega as the periodic system I was looking at. So now, whenever I see a harmonic oscillator, I say, well, this is a periodic system in disguise, but where are its negative energy states? This is the big problem of this picture. Now, there are various ways we can think of addressing this problem. One could be a lock-in mechanism. A lock-in mechanism has long ago already observed, I think by Christian Huygens, the guy who invented the pendulum clock. He already noticed if you take two identical pendulum clocks and you hang them against the same wall, then after a while you discover that they tick in harmony. Then never one clock goes faster than the other, but they are locked in. A lock-in mechanism is well-known experimental physics. As a theoretical physicist, when I studied, I had to go to do experimental physics for half a year, and I learned about the lock-in mechanism. Very useful. But if you have two different clocks, they don't lock in, and then one clock will not be linked to another clock, and because they tick at a different frequency, and then you have no lock-in mechanism. So maybe the lock-in mechanism can be used to find another quantity which is positive just because it's a deterministic thing, and it commutes with the Hamiltonian. In that way, you can limit yourself to states where n and h are locked in by some mechanism, just like the experimental mechanism of the two pendulum clocks. If n is positive and h is locked into n, then h was positive as well. Whereas n is a operator just measuring some feature of the system you're looking at, and h is the operator that generates the evolution of the system. Now, information loss, I have to look at how much time I have, yes. Information loss is perhaps the way to answer this problem. In a universe with information loss is a universe where you have four states. This is the model universe. I have four states. I indicated the evolution law there. And there's a state number 4 which evolves into state number 2. This is an interesting model universe, but you might ask yourself, why state number 4? Because after one step, the universe will never return to that state. So why did they introduce it at all? Well, in a universe with just 4 states, that is an obvious thing to say. But if the universe has billions and billions of states like our universe, it will be extremely hard to say which states are of the type number 4 and which states are type number 1. The thing you can say, however, is that many states are equivalent. State number 1 is equivalent to state number 4, because I know after a certain amount of time, they both evolved to state number 2. And from that moment on, you cannot distinguish those two worlds anymore. So state number 1 and state number 4 are equivalent. I introduce equivalence classes. And then I say, in terms of the equivalence classes, I have only 3 states. Those are called the quantum states. And those, in terms of those, the universe is periodic. Now I'm back at square one. I'm describing a deterministic universe. But if I do this in the universe, I've added a new ingredient. And that is that it's very difficult to identify those local equivalence classes. In fact, they are non-local in a sense. And maybe this is a way to sneak in non-locality in our present understanding of quantum mechanics, because these equivalence classes are defined basically non-locally. The distinction between state number 1 and state number 4, if you go sufficiently far back in time, maybe if they may be different at far separated situations, yet they become equivalent after a while. In fact, this is an extremely interesting idea, because in nature, even in the standard model, we encounter such equivalence classes all the time. In fact, they're called gauge equivalence classes. In the standard model, we have 3 independent gauge groups, U1, SU2, and SU3. They have equivalence classes of the sort. There are many states which are fundamentally indistinguishable we say they're related by a gauge transformation. So in one of my wildest dreams, I believe that maybe these gauge groups have something to do with these informational equivalence classes that we encounter in these primordial theories. Actually, when you add black holes, the equivalence classes become very, very large. In early discussions with Lenny Susskind, he started to ask questions like, take a frog or a rabbit and throw them into a black hole, and after a while, the two black holes become identical. Well, in PowerPoint, I couldn't find a frog and a rabbit, but I could find other creatures just as well. I throw a donkey or a turtle into a black hole, and after a while, these black holes look identical. The information of whether it was a donkey or a turtle has disappeared. So black holes represent very large equivalence classes. Perhaps they do, because we haven't really understood yet everything about their quantum mechanics. So, and this might also explain physically holographic principle. The fact that there are only data on the surface of a black hole, but not inside the bulk, may be because of information loss. Maybe the best way to describe a black hole is that indeed there are lots and lots of things happening inside the black hole, but the information about those things is disappearing because of information loss. And this is presently my belief, that I need information loss to understand how the Hamiltonian can possibly be bounded from below. I need information loss to describe black holes, and I suspect that the result of information loss, the existence of equivalence classes, is already seen in the standard model. There's another result of information loss, and that is that orbits in systems with information loss tend to become discretized. That is to say, if you are sitting in between two of those orbits, you might be attracted to one or to the other. And information as to where exactly in between those orbits you were, that information disappeared. In fact, if I had been Niels Bohr and I had been puzzled about the distinct orbits of electrons around an atom, I'd be thinking of this solution. Of course, I would have been wrong. Quantum mechanics in those days was the correct answer. So I would be a very lousy physicist in those days. But this is what I believe could be a reason as to why, in fact, quantization happens. Why do we find all these discrete states? Well, maybe because nature shows this feature at the Planck scale of generating discrete orbits, which could explain the emergence of quantum numbers. Last question, what about Bell inequalities? I'm sure that this question will be asked, so let me just briefly say something about that. So you have an electron with spin, and you measure an electron with spin in a slightly different direction. And the question is now, can I rotate my apparatus and measure the spin in a different direction as before? So the question is then, if two of such states are being made, and they are correlated in a fundamental quantum mechanical way, how can it be that you can violate so-called Bell inequalities in this picture? There's a lot to be said about this. It's very complicated. My belief is actually the answer could well be in between the apparatus and the electron. If you rotate the apparatus but not the electron, or if you rotate the electron but not the apparatus, then you seem to be doing something that distorts the vacuum in between. But a vacuum is a very complicated state. It's the lowest energy state. It's a superposition of many physical states. So whether it's legal or not to rotate that vacuum is something I find very dubious. And so maybe there's an answer there, that the wave function is a man-made construct, not a physical thing. So to say that you can rotate apparatus without affecting the wave function of the atom, of the electron, while distorting the vacuum in between, is something that I find dubious, and I don't see directly a contradiction there. So the possibility is that deterministic behavior at the Planck scale does not generate deterministic behavior at the atomic scale. There is no determinism at the scale of the standard model, at the scale of the hydrogen atom, and so on. The only thing you've got there is basically chaos with some very peculiar fluctuations. Those fluctuations can be described quantum mechanically. So you have a deterministic behavior at the Planck length, but it doesn't translate into deterministic behavior that you can say, that you can interpret as if electrons come with a little flag attached to them. The flag says, if you measure my spin in the z direction, you get this. If you measure my spin in the x direction, you get this. You all know that that's not the way to describe an electron. There are no electrons with such flags. nor is there a need to add such flags to the electron in a theory of this kind. There hardly is any electron, there's only chaos. There are only fluctuations which look like a quantum electron from at the scale of the standard model. I personally think there are answers to these problems, but I don't have all the answers because I don't have a completely detailed model. So, yes, and finally, at the Planck scale, when you have observables, so it's not viewables, there at the Planck scale, the distinction between an observable and an operator which interchanges observables is very, very clear. Now, to go from the Planck scale to the standard model scale, you have to apply a technique that's physically called the renormalization group. But if you watch what the renormalization group does, is it mixes operators, always fields and admixtures when you go through a randomization group transformation. These admixtures mix all sorts of operators together so that the operators we work with to understand the standard model and the hydrogen atom and such always contain very, very complicated mixtures of operators that tell you what actually is happening, the beable, and the operator says, what would have happened if I made a change? That's called a changeable. And I think the answers are in that direction, but it's very difficult to have very concise answers because explicit models are lacking. I do have some models, but they won't convince any very critical mind. If someone really wants to bombard me, I'm very vulnerable in this position because of the absence of very good models. However, I think it's a very promising way to go, and I think it's necessary. If you really want to understand black holes, if you want to understand the physics, the interpretation of the holographic principle, I think we're forced to go in this direction. So the random numbers, for instance, inherent in the usual statistical interpretation of the wave functions, will probably find their origin at the Planck scale. So God is throwing dice at the Planck scale, which is where we really don't see him doing it. And that's why we were so puzzled and why Niels Bohr had to conclude about the rules of quantum mechanics that became the Copenhagen interpretation. I think my time is more than over, so I thank you for your attention.
Volunteers first.
Yes. I think it makes sense. The whole thing about this is that people always attach too much ontological reality to the wave function. I think the wave function is a man-made construct, and the wave function depends on what you're measuring. If you say that and you stick to that, I don't think there's any contradiction. So it looks like a kind of hidden back reaction. Say, I measure this rather than that. It looks as if that measurement affects the electrons you're looking at, or a photon or whatever, way in its past. It affects its wave function. You can't tell its wave function because it's a man-made construct. And so the fact that measuring something affects its probabilities itself is, I think, nothing to worry about. It implies something like superdeterminism, with which I mean that everything that happens in the universe has been predestined, in a sense. If you have a deterministic theory, everything is fixed. So whether I measure the x or the y component of a spin, for instance, was already predetermined and not something I have freedom to choose in the last minute. And this is a very confusing feature of free will, about which I can extend at length. But basically, yes, there are some limits to the freedom of our will that we have. If I decide to measure this rather than that, that decision has its roots in equations of nature in the long and distant past, in a very, very hidden way. There's nothing wrong about that. The Planck degree of freedom, they all talk to each other locally, but it gives rise to very rapid correlations as compared to the speed of light. And so, well, to make a long story short, I don't see a straight contradiction with what all these people say. But I also realize that the arguments sometimes look very compelling. What I would stress, however, is there is no determinism at the scale of atoms or even the standard model. But that the only way we can handle the effects of physical laws at that scale is by using fluctuations or correlations, and those correlations are only described in quantum mechanics. And then you say, yes, they're only described in quantum mechanics, but quantum mechanics using just the rules defined in a textbook. Those wave functions used there have no direct physical meaning. And that's the best answer I can give, which is not very, I realize myself, it's not very convincing if you don't believe it. If you really look at the models which are there and which are all wanting, so the only models I can give you are models that you can criticize. But some of those models seem to show that, yes, you should be able to get away with this.
Steve and Harvey.
I agree that you can get around the Bell inequalities by postulating some sort of superdeterminism. I see what you're getting at there. What I'm a little bit confused about is the nature of the determinism that you have on the fundamental scale. It seems like the theory, at least the sketch of it that you presented, is deterministic into the future and indeterministic into the past. You have state one and state four both feeding into state two, so the time reverse of that has state two forking without any definite probabilities into either state one or state four. So is it accurate to say that this is a theory with a fundamental time asymmetry built in? And if so, what does this superdeterminism mean? Does the superdeterminism have this asymmetry in it as well?
Well, yeah, the question of time reversal symmetry now becomes a very interesting one. And it is illustrated in this picture here that the original deterministic theory is very much asymmetric. This by the time reversal. State number two has two pasts, but only one future. And that is a state without a past, state number four. And some states always have a past. That's very asymmetric. However, as soon as you introduce the equivalence classes, you say this picture, you can run forward as well as backward. So suddenly in this picture, you see that there's no time preference anymore. So my belief is the reason why our quantum description of the world has time reversal symmetry in it is because the quantum description is at this lowest line here in terms of equivalence classes. These could be gauge equivalence classes, and you always say never even try to experimentally determine which gauge you're in because you can't. So you can't figure out whether you're state number one or state number four. But one of those has another thing in its past. And so in terms of these equivalence classes, you can go forward as well as backwards in time. In fact, there's an interesting mapping of this. It becomes rather mathematical, but you can map this into a model which does the same thing backwards in time. So, but then you have to use the quantum notation. So it really means if you want to understand time reversibility, you first have to cast this model in a quantum language, and then you can consider superpositions and things, and then you can go backwards in time.
I just wanted to follow up Robin's point about non-locality. If you're prepared to accept the Cartesian-Speckle theorem and the contextualism, the contextual nature of properties in quantum mechanics, then you can use the Cartesian and Speckle theorem for pairs of spin one systems and also derive a non-locality result completely independently of any inequalities. So it seems to me that there again, it could be a threat to locality. I'd also like to know whether or not there's some mechanism within your fundamental dynamics that prevents something like a generalization of the Poincaré recurrence theorem. If there were such a recurrence phenomenon in the dynamics, then it's hard to see how the information loss could be irreversible.
Well, to begin with the last thing, this, of course, is a Poincaré recurrence, right? This model turns back into itself after three steps. So and that's very important. That seems to have to, so this model ultimately reaches a frequency with this period. And in some of my more mathematical attempts to get this in line with quantum mechanics as we know it, it seems that that frequency corresponds to the energy of the system. So eventually, if you be able to isolate a system completely from the rest of the universe, is it going to a Poincaré cycle? Just because of information loss, it might go into a very small cycle. And these small cycles have small recurrence times, and that corresponds to the actual energy of that system. In reality, of course, the universe has only coupled regions, and the entire universe is one coupled thing. And that, well, perhaps the universe one day will go into a recurrence cycle, but that will take many times a lifetime of the universe as we know it. So then it will never happen. But for the rest, I might as well try to understand what else it was that you wanted to ask. I don't know what else, could you repeat what else you wanted to ask, or did I answer the question? Oh yes, non-locality. It's true that the relation between these two states is non-local, because they might be equivalent only after a million steps, they might return to the same state. But after a million steps, information could have seeped through a million sites. So the distinction between state one and state four could be quite non-local. And so if the form one equivalence class, then of course you get the impression that there's extreme amount of non-locality in physics. But non-locality is just basically fake. Just like in a gauge theory, if you impose some gauge condition, often you get some apparent non-local behavior. For instance, in a Coulomb gauge, you get an instantaneous Coulomb force. See, that's non-local, because if I displace this charge, immediately the field at the other object changes as well. But you know that it's fake, that's a consequence of you that you fix the gauge. Similarly here, you get some fake non-locality. And I think that's ultimately the non-locality in quantum mechanics, and then try to interpret it. As you know very well, you can never make use of that non-locality to send any message faster than the speed of light. That's impossible. That has been proven within the standard model. There's no way you can send a message faster than the speed of light. And of course, in the original ontological theory I have here, nothing has to go faster than the speed of light, so there will be locality there. But so I think this picture, to me, looks consistent, and I have difficulty in translating that into the language that people use when they prove non-locality, because they start with a quantum picture and determinism, say at the length scale of the photons and the electrons that they are looking at. I say there's no determinism at that scale. It only happens at the Planck scale. But the only way to translate that into properties of electrons and photons is we're using the randomization group, for which are forced first to adopt the quantum language. So we're forced to use quantum mechanics to describe atoms and to describe any experiment where you're trying to check Bell's inequalities. So for that reason, I don't see a contradiction. On the other hand, I do see the problem, and the best answer I should come up with is make a decent model that tells you how interference phenomena take place, and so on and so forth, and yet has determinism at Planck length. That I have not been able to do.
I'd like to ask about the connection of something you said at the beginning and at the end. You said that basically gravity is non-renormalizable if you want to make a quantum theory of it. But then at the end, after you discuss what happens at short distance scales, you said quantum mechanics may be quite different or becomes a deterministic theory. At any rate, it's a different theory at these Planck length scales. Therefore, one would conclude that you're saying that it's impossible to quantize gravity because there is no quantum theory at the shortest distance scales. There's some other sub-quantum theory. Am I misunderstanding what you what misconcluding?
So here you see if I describe a deterministic model, I use genuine, acceptable quantum mechanical language to describe it. By doing that, I've adopted quantum mechanics. So I'm not saying that quantum mechanics is wrong. I'm not saying you have to replace it by something else. I'm saying quantum mechanics is a superb mathematical machine to study statistical fluctuations in an unconventional way. There are other examples in theoretical physics where quantum mechanics is used to solve a problem, even though the problem itself is not a quantum mechanical one, in statistical physics, for instance. And that is what I believe about quantum mechanics. It is a superb tool. It is exact as a mathematical tool, but it doesn't really describe the physics that's going on. So at the Planck scale, I believe that something like this is happening, a very much more complicated version of this model here, which is deterministic. But we have to use the quantum mechanical notation and then the quantum mechanical renormalization group to arrive at the description of our world, which is genuinely quantum mechanics, not fake quantum mechanics, but really quantum mechanics, except that we haven't recognized it as such. So we haven't recognized as yet what the source is of our world appearing to be quantum mechanical. So I'm not dismissing quantum mechanics at all. So I would still like to talk about quantum gravity as such, because I still think that it's absolutely necessary to reconcile gravity with what we know of quantum mechanics. You can't have a completely classical gravity. That's not going to work. Gravity will have to obey the same actions of quantum mechanics as any other force. But then maybe the whole lot is combined into something deeper and more fundamental and perhaps more deterministic at the Planck scale.
I think, unfortunately, we have a cutoff. I know there are some more questions, but the bistro has arranged a reception for Professor Tuft and all of us. So I hope people will come and bring their questions to Gerard. And we thank you very much and see you upstairs. Thank you.